Hi, this is Ron Hogan, and you are listening to Life Stories, a Beatrice.com podcast. My guest today is Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, tell me a little bit about the moment at the start of Wild where you decide you're going to do this journey.
Okay. It was the winter of... it was actually December of 1994. I was 26 years old. I was living in Minneapolis and working as a waitress and really at what I think of as the bottom of my life. My mother, who I'd been very close to, had died suddenly of cancer about 3.5 years before. She was 45. I was 22. And really at that point, my life, sort of split apart and I had to remake myself and I was having a really hard time. Sort of just growing up, going through the struggles that we all do in our early 20s, but also really trying to figure out how I was going to live in this world without my mom. I had been married at the time, and so I sort of spun out and did all kinds of reckless, self-destructive things and was in the course of getting a divorce from this husband I loved. When I was standing in an REI store just outside of Minneapolis, and I saw this book called The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. I'd never heard of the Pacific Crest Trail. I had not been a long-distance backpacker. But I picked the book up and read the back, and something about it spoke to me. Something about it called to me. And I didn't buy it at that moment, but the next day I went back and did buy it. And I decided to set out on this trail.
And then so a couple of months later, you find yourself in the Mojave Desert.
Right. Well, a few months later, yeah. So this was December when I first picked up the book, and I began my hike in June of 95. And what I did in those intervening months was I really read that guidebook over and over, and I prepared in all these ways in terms of purchasing gear, saving up my money from my waitressing shift to purchase all the backpacker gear I needed, mapping out my trip, boxing up the dehydrated food I would send myself on the trail. And then in June, I find myself in the Mojave Desert on the Pacific Crest Trail. And it turns out, in spite of all the preparation I'd done, the sort of logistical preparation, that I didn't know at all what I was doing in terms of what it meant to carry a backpack over that rough terrain. I had never gone backpacking before.
Right. There's a scene when you're in the hotel room in the Mojave Desert and you're putting on the backpack for the first time that really sort of underscores that it's like you... up until that point, you had never even tried to lift this thing up.
I had never even packed it. A lot of that stuff, I drove from Minneapolis to Portland, flew to Los Angeles, and then caught a ride to this little town called Mojave. And yeah, you're right, in this little cheap motel, I packed up for the first time. And I was so unprepared that I was even, ripping things from its packaging, And usually you would take things on a trial run. And I just didn't do that for a number of reasons. The great conundrum was I could not lift my pack. I couldn't lift my pack even an inch, but I had to carry it over 1,100 miles. And so much of what Wild is about is that very literal experience being also a metaphorical one, having to do with, what I was really out there trying to figure out was how was I going to bear the weight of my life or the truths of my life that felt unbearable to me.
Right. There's a passage about halfway through where you talk about how, you're on this journey and you had set out on this journey with the idea of, okay, I'm going to get away from all the distractions of the outside world and I'm going to confront, all these things that have happened to me over the last few years and contemplate them and think about them and deal with this stuff. And then you get out there and you're basically, what you're dealing with, in fact, is your immediate physical pain of being on this journey every day.
Mm-hmm. That was really such an important part of what I had to learn. And I didn't expect that. I expected to get out there and to have the spiritual experience I was looking for. And I had really muted my imagination of the sort of physical trials I would face and how just very physical the day-to-day, struggle would be. And because I had to struggle so much, because it was so physically uncomfortable, and even when I was doing okay, I still had to carry this big weight and cover a bunch of miles every day. I was engaged with that in a way I had never been before. It was like I was out, I was finally pulled out of my head and my heart and into my body in a way that ended up over time very much alleviating those other sufferings. it was a revelation to me, that kind of physical experience being the way to a cure, if you will.
Now, as you said, this journey, this hike was in the summer of 95. And, you know, here we are now in 2012. And I assume it was probably about, like, you know, 2 or 3 years ago that you actually did the writing here.
Right.
Why was 2009, 2010, say, the right moment to tell this story after, a decade and a half?
It was really just a little bit of one of those coincidences, not so much a coincidence. I just simply found myself writing about the experience. I had this idea that I would publish a collection of personal essays because I've written several and they're, they've been published here, there, and everywhere. And I thought it would be fun to have just a little book that's a collection of essays. And so I, put together, they do sort of tell the story of my 20s and my childhood. And I thought, well, the missing piece is my hike on the Pacific Crest Trail. So I'll just write an essay about it, and that will round out the collection. So I started to write this in the summer of 2008. And I found that, much to my surprise, I realized I had this big story to tell, and I had a lot to say about it. And it was after so many years that, it was only after so many years that I could tell that story, because what I wanted to bring into the book, even though in the book I'm not saying, looking back now, that I'm not doing that explicitly, implicitly, I'm bringing my perspective of the years on that hike, what that hike really meant to me over time in my life. And so I feel fortunate that it took that long for me to really land on deciding to tell the story.
And while you were on the hike, you were journaling.
Yeah, well, yeah. I kept a journal, but I wasn't keeping a journal because I was on the hike. I kept a journal religiously all through my 20s and into my 30s. I was just one of those girls in the cafe who was always holding her journal, and writing. So I documented everything in the same way that I documented my years off the trail. And it was a great resource for me when I did decide to write the book.
And in addition to drawing on your own personal account, your contemporaneous account, how much tracking down of the other people that you encountered on the path did you end up doing?
I did some. It didn't seem important to me to talk to every person I met on the trail, because I was, I was telling my story. A memoir is the, the story of your subjective truth. So, I very much knew I was going to be speaking of my experience through my perspective. But nonetheless, I did track down as many people as I could who I wrote about in the book. And that was sometimes possible, other times not so possible. Some of the people have common enough names that if I hadn't kept in touch with them over the years, a Google search would turn up thousands of people with their name, and I couldn't find them. But I did talk to some people, and I would say in my email to them, hey, I'm writing a book, and, it is through my perspective, so it's not like I'm doing hard research here, but would you tell me, what do you remember of when we met, or this experience we had together? And I would try to say as little as possible myself, because I didn't want to influence them. I really wanted to know what their memory was. And the thing that struck me the most was how often they remembered something exactly as I remembered it. Like, they would remember right down to the detail. And I was so sort of relieved by that, because memory does get this bad rap. And then there were a couple times where people would write to me and they would remember, some other detail that I had forgotten, that I was then able to, that once they reminded me of it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that now. And I was able to pull that into the book, which was really kind of cool. I do wish that I'd been able to track down a few more people than I was able to. But since Wild has come out, they have found me because they hear me on, the radio or whatever. And they say, I met that woman on that hike, and a few of them have emailed me, which has been really nice.
And because this was such a transformative experience for you, and, it's clearly shaped a lot of what has come after. And, in writing about it, you're writing from that future perspective, implicitly. In the writing of it, were there aspects of it that sort of like surprised you that you hadn't realized about before, that only sort of came to you as you sat down to tell the story?
A lot of it. Really, I'm the sort of writer who very much discovers the story through writing. And I think that my experience of the hike, even though I knew that I felt internally transformed and by that hike, I felt it in my body, you know. But when I came to actually write about that experience, I really understood it on a deeper level. And also, you know, some of the metaphors, for example, in the book, I call my backpack monster, because I gave it that nickname on the trail because it was so heavy. It was this monster of a weight. And I think at the time I wasn't thinking metaphorically, you know, and when I wrote the book, I realized, yeah, I was carrying a monster on my back and it had a literal weight, but it also had a metaphorical weight that I was, you know, facing down my own demons on that journey. And so things like that came up when you find yourself writing about them. You can see things more symbolically, I think, in a way that you just don't in real life. And so a lot of the meanings, you know, the sort of the rivers and the bridges and the paths and all those things lent themselves to something deeper that I could only really mine once I was writing about it.
And from the essays that you had before, it sounds like you developed a personal voice or a voice of a personal experience through there, which, you know, also plays into Wild. But did you see, you know, your sort of that personal voice evolving or shifting as the story got longer than from the your voice in the essays?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to learn how to write a memoir by writing a memoir. Just like when I wrote my first book, Torch, I remember I was about 100 or so pages into it. And I thought, this is absolutely ludicrous because, you know, I'd written short stories by then. And I thought, well, how do you learn how to just go on longer? Like, how do you write a novel? And I realized the only way I could do it was by writing a novel. It teaches you how to do it. And, you know, the memoir does have a different pace and a different tone than the essays. I think my personal essays tend to have just an intensity of tone and pace that in the book-length memoir I had to tamp down a little bit because you're in it for a longer stretch, and so I had to learn how to draw out a story over, you know, 400 pages versus, you know, 30, and that was a great challenge for me and an interesting lesson as well.
And what happens to those essays now, the ones that you were like, oh, I almost have a book here?
Right. Well, they've all been published, you know, in places, and a couple of them have been in the Best American Essays or the Pushcart Prize Anthology. So they have their own life. And, you know, I'd love to write essays, and I do think that someday I will put them out in a collection. Most publishers aren't crazy about publishing essay collections. I don't know why. I love personal essays myself. But I've even thought, I mean, I haven't approached my publisher with the idea of publishing a collection of my essays, but I could. And what I feel like is in this day and age, even if no publisher wants it, it could be something that I just sort of self-published or as an ebook or something, because I get enough emails from people saying, hey, you know, such and such essay is not online, but I would really love to read it. And can you send it to me? And it would be nice to have a place to send those people so they could really get my essays. Mm-hmm.
And on the subject of voice, so you have like the essay voice, you've honed the memoir voice now, and right around the time that Wild was coming out, the world learned that you are also the voice of Sugar, the advice columnist for The Rumpus. And how did that sort of come about?
Well, it was really, writing the Dear Sugar column has been one of the most interesting experiences to me, both as a human and a writer, because it all just came on as a surprise. I was asked to take over the column by Steve Almond, who had been writing it before me. He wrote the first 26 of the Sugar columns. And the moment that he asked me to do it, I had just sent off my first draft of Wild to my editor. So it was in this little lull where I was waiting to hear back from her, what she thought, her notes for revision on the book. And Steve emailed me and said, would you like to take over this column? I said, yes. And I really at the time had no idea that it would become what it did. I did know that if I was going to do it, I was going to really do it. And I was going to give it everything. I wasn't going to be just this little side thing that was, you know, that I wasn't going to put much into. Once I started writing it, I realized I was going to be very serious about it. And I did turn it into this sort of hybrid of you know, it is self-help. You know, I'm giving people advice, but it's also the literary personal essay because I often do tell stories from my own life in it. And I learned a lot. I mean, one of the things that's so different about the Sugar Column that's different from any of the other writing I've done is there is the luxury of that direct address. You know, in my other writing, I'm not trying to convey a message. And if I am, it's incredibly covert. You know, I'm not saying, dear reader, here's what I think you should do. Here's the meaning I think you should take from this. And in Sugar, I'm actually addressing somebody who's written me a letter. It's an essay in the form of a letter. And it opened up a whole world for me in terms of voice. It's very much my voice. People who have read my essays or even my novel Torch or my memoir Wild, they recognize Dear Sugar. But it's also this wonderfully new terrain. And suddenly now there's a book coming out of my collected columns, Tiny Beautiful Things. It's going to be published by Vintage in July. And I do believe that the category is going to be self-help, which is really hilarious to me that I've become like an accidental self-help writer.
And during that period where Sugar's identity was, it sounds like some people knew, although it wasn't really bandied about until quite recently. So was that semi-anonymity bordering on total anonymity, was that liberating in terms of the finding Sugar's voice or finding a voice for that call?
I think at first it was, because I did have some doubts. I thought, well, who am I to give anyone advice? And I thought, well, if I completely bombed at it, that nobody would ever have to know it was me. But once I started doing well with it, I did feel like the anonymity was getting in the way. A lot of readers would say, well, you know, readers who wanted me to stay anonymous would say, I fear that once you are no longer anonymous, you won't feel as free to write as intimately as you do. And of course, I knew the sort of stuff I was writing as Cheryl Strayed, which was very open and intimate. And I would say, no, trust me. It wasn't the anonymity that was freeing. And in fact, it was constricting by the end because I felt like I was in some ways bound. There were certain things I couldn't quite write about because it would just give it away so much, you know, to anyone and who'd read my work. And so many people who had read my work by the end were guessing. I would say hundreds of people by then had written to me by the time I revealed my identity to say, you must be Dear Sugar. And so it was really high time to come out because it was one of those things everyone who knew kept the secret. But, you know, inevitably that was going to someday, somebody was going to make a tweet and say, I know it's Cheryl Strayed or, you know, comment on Facebook or something. But so I came out right when I felt like the whole, you know, it would have all come out anyway. And it hasn't changed my relationship to the column whatsoever. I feel like I still will write it the same way and with the same, you know, sort of freedoms and constraints that I always have.
Right. And it seems like, in fact, that now that sort of the guessing game aspect of who is Dear Sugar is gone, you know, it actually allows people to focus on the column itself.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think in some ways that guessing game was maybe getting in the way. It certainly felt it to me by the end. I felt burdened by the secret, and also even just with friends in conversation, not always able to remember who knew and who didn't know. When they'd say, well, what are you up to? What do you have to do tonight? And I couldn't say, well, I have to go home and write a Sugar column. Like, it just, that sort of thing became, you know, tiresome for me. I'm so glad that I'm out now. Also, that work, I came to see it as really important work to me as a writer. It's work that I really put everything into. And, you know, I always knew that I wanted to be able to claim that as part of my body of work, too. So that feels great, too, to be able to say, yeah, I wrote that. I wrote that piece.
And now that Wild is out in the world and you've created this document about, you know, one of the most transformative experiences of your life and something that has really shaped, I think, the whole second half of your life. Now that it's out in the world and you're sharing that with people, how is that process going for you on the book tour, for example? Mm-hmm.
It's been really moving and also sort of overwhelming because I think any writer will relate to this, but especially memoirists, is, you know, you just make this book and you're very private about that. I mean, you're alone with the work in your room or wherever it is you write and writing that story that does happen to be a true story in your story. And so it feels very small and very much, you know, private, I guess, even though, of course, you're creating this public document. And so when the book comes out and you go into bookstores and people come up to you and talk to you about your story and sometimes cry or share things about their lives based on what you wrote, it is such a powerful experience because it's a way of crossing across that divide with a stranger. You're finding a place of intimacy, even though you've never spoken to that person before. And so it's powerful and moving and also overwhelming. There's a way that I feel just overwhelmingly grateful and also unable to even articulate that gratitude to people who come up to me and say, thank you for writing this book.
And where is your writing headed now? Is it, still in memoir territory or essay or back to fiction maybe?
Yeah, I think all of the above. Right now, I'm really so busy because I do have these two books coming out back to back. And I am still writing the Dear Sugar column. Mm-hmm. I'm on a little hiatus right now, but I'll go back to it. I feel like in the fall, when things after these two books are out and I've calmed down a bit from promoting them, I had started a novel late last year. I've written about the first 60 or 70 pages of it, and I would really love to go back to it and write another novel. I think sometimes it can be fun to move just in another direction. You know, when I've been in the land of memoir and nonfiction now between the Dear Sugar columns and the essays and Wild for some time now, and I'm really taken up by this fictional story that I have in my head and partially on the page, and I'd really like to work on that. I also do have a few essays that I've started and been too busy to finish. And I think that those are the places I'm going to focus my attention next.
And did you ever go back to the trail or to any other sort of backpacking trips after the summer of 95?
I've gone backpacking since then, never for as long. I've gone on 1 and 2 week backpacking trips in the Wallawas in Oregon and the Continental Divide Trail in New Mexico. And I always go hiking every summer on the Pacific Crest Trail with my husband and kids. I live in Portland, Oregon, and so it's really only about an hour or so from the Pacific Crest Trail, where it crosses the Columbia River, where I ended my trip, and also up in the Cascades near Timberline Lodge and such. And so I do get up there and hike.
Great. And so now, you've probably hiked some of the Washington portion of it as well.
Yeah. But my big plan is I have two kids who are ages 6 and almost 8. And I would really love when they're a few years older, when they're just, before they reach the surly teenage years, but when they're old enough to really to take on such a thing, I would really love to hike with my family the Washington section of the PCT. It's approximately 500 miles long. It would take us, a big chunk of a summer. But I think it would be a really fun thing to do, to walk from the place where I ended my trip in 95 to the end of the PCT in Canada. It ends about 6 or 7 miles across the Canadian border, north of Washington.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you get to make that trip someday.
I do too.
Great. Cool. Well, this has been Life Stories. I'm Ron Hogan. I've been talking with Cheryl Strayed about her memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. It's just out from Knopf, so go look for it. And keep an eye on Beatrice.com for a future installment of Life Stories. Thanks.